Thanks for having me here. I did just fly in this morning. I realized I was in a different country. I came in, and just as I came in, I was hearing someone say something that, well, we agree that that health care and pensions are a social responsibility. I realized, different country. Most of you probably heard of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and it's kind of, you know, we're hitting a deadline. March 31st is when people are supposed to be enrolled, and it's sort of like a football score. They report how many people do they have enrolled each day. So, you know, we're rooting, you know, we'll see what we get up to. So anyhow, so you invite someone from the United States, and you know, you're talking about pensions in England, so naturally I talk about housing in the United States. So I figured I'd focus on something that I know, or at least can claim to know. But no, I will argue that I want to give the story housing as part of retirement, and I will venture a guess that I think a lot of what I have to say is relevant to UK, and you can decide the extent to which it is or it isn't. But I think we've had similar experiences in many ways, and some of the same pitfalls, you know, perhaps greater, perhaps less in different cases. So the main points I want to go through, first off, decline of defined benefit pensions. Again, I think a similar story in UK. I'll outline what it's looked like in the US. The failure to define contribution pensions, we basically could talk about, you know, workers now. We've had defined contribution pensions long enough that we have sort of the first generation of workers hitting retirement that have spent most of their working years in defined contribution pensions. And I think the story there isn't very good. Then I want to talk about home equity as a share of net worth. And again, it's not because I have a fixation with housing. The point is that houses for most people, I'm giving away the punchline here, but houses for most people, most middle-income people, that will be far and away their major source of wealth. That's certainly true in the United States. Again, I won't, you know, I know some of the data in the UK, but again, you know that all better than I do. Next point, houses are volatile. That's not a secret today. That did seem to be a secret 10 years ago, but that should suggest to me, at least, that that should be a big concern for public policy. And then the last point, I'll just, you know, say in passing, labor force participation of older workers. I think that's kind of proof of the pudding that, you know, what's happened to labor force participation for older workers in the downturn. Now, I'll just say, make a qualification here, because I often talk about housing and retirement in the United States, and people will point to these polls. There ain't a number of surveys you could point to where people are asked, do you expect to rely on the wealth in your home in retirement? And most people don't. You know, that's their answer. And I guess what I'd say is I think most people, when they're answering that question, it's sort of like, well, what would be good to eat for breakfast, you know, 2 weeks from now? I mean, you know, what does that mean? I don't think people have given it thought. And I'll just mention three ways in which people do rely on the equity in their wealth in their home, whether they consciously plan it or not. First off, we have reverse mortgages. I don't know if you have that same institution in UK. I mean, people could withdraw money from their home, you know, by taking out a normal mortgage, but we actually have instituted something that's referred to as a reverse mortgage, where, say, I'm going to draw down a certain amount a month. I have $100,000 equity in my home, so I'm going to pull $50,000 of that out over 10 years, so the bank's going to send me, you know, I don't know what that comes to, $300 a month, $400, whatever that would end up coming to. So that's now a formal mortgage instrument that is growing very rapidly. Last year, I looked at that recently, I think there's about 15 or 16 billion, and it's growing at high double digits, like 20-25% annual rate. So people are directly taking money out that way. More often, I think it's indirect that, you know, that on the one hand, a lot of people move down. You have a lot of people that have the house that when they retire, they're still living in the house that they raised their kids. You know, they have a big house. They plan to move to something smaller because, you know, it's one or two people in retirement. They don't need such a big house. Well, they're planning on being able to do that, you know, that they have enough equity in that home to be able to do that so they could buy something outright, or often have money put aside, you know, extra money that they'll then be able to live off of. So, you know, again, if we ask that person, do you plan to use the equity in your home, what are you talking about, do you plan to move down, many people answer yes to that question, and they do that. The last point is simply having a paid-off house. You know, again, people might not consciously think about this, but, you know, it's in their head. They might not think they're accumulating equity, but the idea is that, you know, when they're retired, they will not still be paying off a mortgage. Now, in many cases, that turns out not to be true. But obviously, it's a very, very big difference in your living standards when you're retired, whether you still have a mortgage payment to make or not. So that's, again, a way in which people are using equity in their home that, you know, they may not perceive it that way. They do intend to have, you, again, asking them that question, do you plan on the equity in your home supporting your retirement? Answer might be no. Do you expect to have a paid-off mortgage? Well, yes. Okay, so my point here is simply that I think the vast majority of homeowners do expect to rely on the equity in their home to support them in retirement one way or another. So that means we have to take that very seriously as part of their retirement income. Even if they answer our question, they don't count on it. Okay, the first point, the drop in defined benefit pensions, this is for the private sector, and this just shows you, you know, the, you know, rapidity with which it's fallen. And overwhelmingly, the basic story is that if you accept in large establishments, large firms, you don't have pensions in the private sector anymore. And even a lot of those are moving away from defined benefit pensions. So, you know, you'll still have, particularly where you have a union, which again are disappearing rapidly in the US. I know it's a similar story, not as dramatic in the UK. But except in a relatively small number of large firms, still a fair number of employees, defined benefit pensions are going down rapidly. So it's well below 20%. This is 2011 data. You know, it's dropping year by year. You know, so it's defined benefit pensions are disappearing very, very rapidly. Okay, just a different cut of this, just making the point by firm size. Again, this is 2011, 1 to 49, less than 10% of smaller firms offer defined benefit pensions. And no new firms, by the way. It's all, you know, these are all pensions that have been there, you know, for the most part, 10, 15, 20 years. No one is starting a defined benefit pension in the United States. And, you know, I always ask people, you know, do you know of any defined benefit pensions that have been started in the last decade? So they're going down very, very fast. Now, this is private sector. I should just say we do still have defined benefit pensions are relatively common still in the public sector. That's, you know, around 15% of our labor force. Those are very much under attack. It's a political football at this point. There are real efforts to cut those back, replace them with defined contribution pensions. For the most part, that's not happened yet. Whether that will continue to be the case, hard to say. Utah, for example, did replace many of their defined benefit pensions, the state of Utah, with defined contribution. Utah, I should tell you, is like, I think it's the most Republican state in the country. If it's not the most, it's one of the most. So, that, yeah.
So is that firms or establishments?
That's a good question. These are establishments. These are establishments. So in the way the Bureau of Labor Statistics does the accounting, General Motors might have 20 or 30 or 40 establishments. You know, so each, it's by establishment. Good question, though. So some of the small establishments here will actually be parts of large firms. And in fact, that's a very good point. The 1 to 49 employees, probably a lot of those are, you know, branches of a large firm. Very good point. Okay, so anyhow, so public, just to finish up what I was saying, that defined benefit pension plans are disappearing rapidly in the private sector. Public sector, they're still holding on, but again, it is a very contentious political issue to date. Again, Utah, there might be a few others, you know, at the local level where they've replaced defined benefit plans with defined contribution. It hasn't happened on a large scale yet. I couldn't guarantee that, you know, if we're having this discussion 5 years from now, that will still be true. Again, it's a very contentious issue, very much up for debate. Okay, retirement accounts. So this is the story of defined contribution plans. And my point here in showing these is simply to say that most people haven't accumulated very much. So this is recent data. This is the 2012 Federal Reserve Board publication. It's 2010 data, I should be clear on that, because it would look a little better today. 2010, the stock market had partially recovered, or well above the lows, but obviously it's kept rising, so it would look somewhat better today, but I don't think hugely different. So just to take some of the numbers here, the middle quintile, the 40 to 59.9 percentiles, this is obviously middle-income people, just a little more than half of them have retirement accounts, and the median holdings in those accounts is just over, it's just about 22,000-23,000. So what we could say is that 75% of people in the middle quintile have less than 25,000 in their account. Okay, that's not gonna get you very far in retirement. Moving up to the fourth quintile, okay, most people, 70%, have retirement accounts, but the median holding there is only about 35,000. Okay, so we could say there that we have two-thirds of people in the fourth quintile. These are clearly, you know, above the median income. They have less than 35,000 in a retirement account. Okay, that's not going very far. Okay, the next one, just doing it by age, obviously, you know, we do expect people to accumulate as they go through their working careers. Again, it's not a pretty story, at least in my view. You know, so if we look at the 45 to 54 group, that's in some ways a really good group to look at, because these people, through their whole working careers, have been in the defined contribution systems. Okay, most of those people don't have defined benefit pensions. They go back, you know, basically defined contribution began to take off in the United States early 80s. So someone who's in this age group, 45 to 54, they've been in defined contribution pensions during the years we expect them to be accumulating money. So 60% have defined contribution pensions, but the median holding in those pensions is only $60,000. So what that means is that 70% have less than $60,000. Okay, they'll accumulate a little more before retirement, but again, that's not going to get them very far. So we're talking about people, the middle distribution clearly don't have very much money. If you take the older group, the 55 to 64 group, there the median holding's 100,000. So there you have, you know, these are peak, you know, they're peak holdings. So you have 30% have more than 100,000, 70% have less. Okay, so I think by any reasonable measure, I think it's fair to say that defined contribution is not going to provide a comfortable retirement for very many people. I'll keep going on that forever, but point is, most people don't have very much money in defined contribution pensions. Okay, this is where they do have money, and the point here is that this obviously was hugely affected by the crash. So what I have here is equity before and after the crash. So we have data from 2004, a survey of consumer finance taken in 2004. These were actually projections that we made for 2009, and they turned out to be very much on the mark, so I didn't go back and redo them very carefully. But the basic point here is people did have substantial wealth, substantial equity in their home. So if you take a look even at the second quintile, back in 2004, the average equity in their home was about $40,000, $35,000. Okay, that was considerably more than the third quintile had in defined contribution accounts. Looking at the middle quintile, average equity back in 2004 was over $100,000. Okay, it was about $110,000, $120,000. This is way more than what these people had in their defined contribution accounts. And of course, the fourth quintile, it was about $180,000, $185,000. Okay, so this is way more. This is the 45 to 54 year old group. So it's not people just about to retire. These are people still have opportunity to accumulate more equity. They had a fairly large amount of equity in their home, certainly way more than what they had in their defined contribution accounts. Now, of course, it disappeared after the collapse. Okay, and the logic here, it's fairly obvious. Even in normal times, housing is a highly leveraged asset. That got to be more so, you know, during the bubble years. Traditionally, people in the United States put down 20% as a mortgage when you got a home, so you're getting, you know, a ratio 5-1. So even then, you know, normal times, it's a highly leveraged asset. That really went out the window during our bubble years. You had the National Association of Realtors kept data on this. First-time home buyers in 2005, almost half of them had zero equity, put down payments of zero. And in fact, in many cases, it was negative. You had a lot of mortgages, a lot of cases where people were able to borrow more than the value of their house to cover closing costs or just to put money in their pocket. So even in normal times, as I say, obviously housing, you know, I think that's true everywhere. I know it's true in the UK, but housing's always gonna be highly leveraged. Not too many people could buy a house with cash, you know, so we expect it to be leveraged. But it became even more leveraged, you know, during our bubble years. And the implication of that, of course, is, you know, if the price goes up, wonderful. Price plummets, you get wiped out. Okay, and that's kind of my next slide. This is the percent of homeowners that needed cash to close on their primary residence. And, you know, again, this is 45 to 54. 45 to 54 year olds. These are people you would have expected to have accumulated some equity in their house.
What do you mean, cash to close?
I was about to explain that. Okay, so these are people, you know, at 45 to 54, you'd expect they've accumulated, in many cases, a second home, a third home, you know, they've moved up, they would have some equity. Okay, when I'm saying cash to close, on the one hand, we had a lot of people that were literally underwater, they owed more than the value of their house. typically in the U.S., closing costs somewhere around 6% of your sale price, mostly the realtor. We just took the number 6%. You know, it would most of that goes to realtor. Depends on your jurisdiction. In a lot of states, you have to pay a turnover fee, a transactions tax when you close. You know, it's divided up different ways between the buyers and the sellers. 6% is probably on the low side. Okay, and obviously you can sell your house yourself. Most people do use a realtor. It's something like 80%, but you can do it yourself and save yourself the 6%. But, you know, again, most people are going to use a realtor. So the point here is that you have people that are, you know, well into their working careers, you know, not very far from retirement, and they, if they want to leave their house, they have to have some other source of money. Now, again, you can negotiate short sales. That was done to some extent. It's done increasingly. Short sales meaning that, you know, I don't know if they have the same term in the UK, you work out with the bank that, you know, you owe $200,000 on your mortgage, the house is worth $180,000, they'll accept the $180,000, say, okay, it's paid off in full. That happens sometimes. But the point is, it's not going to be an easy thing for you to sell that house. You have to negotiate that. You can't just, you know, call up your bank and say, hey, my house is only worth $180,000. I've got someone who's going to pay that. You know, you'll take that, right? You know, you have to negotiate that. So point is, people are locked into their homes, and people not very far from retirement basically have nothing. They have nothing by way of equity. Okay, similar sort of story, just again to show the same picture with the older group, the 55 to 64. Again, you see both two points that I'd make here. One, this is where their money was. This is where people had their money. So again, looking at the second quintile, these people basically have nothing for the most part in retirement accounts. So if you look at our second quintile, very few of those people have anything to mention in terms of accumulation of defined contribution account. Well, their average holdings in a home back in 2004 was about $65,000. Okay, so basically nothing in retirement accounts, $65,000 average equity in their home. For the middle quintile, again, you just saw, you know, that 70% had less than $100,000. In this case, the average equity, this again, 2004, was about $180,000. Okay, so people had equity in their home. They didn't have money in a retirement account. Again, the fourth quintile, it was up around $370,000. So people did have equity in their home. They didn't have money in retirement accounts. And again, same story. You see a big fall off. Not quite as much, not quite as big a fall off with the younger group, because obviously at this point, homes aren't as leveraged. You have the older group, 55 to 64, they've paid off more of a mortgage. So they didn't take quite as big a percentage hit. They lost more in absolute dollars, but they didn't take quite as big a percentage hit. And I could show you the same story. I don't have the slide here, but same story, you know, in terms of percentage of these people that would need cash to close. A very high percent of people, 55 to 64, needed cash to close in this story. Yeah?
I'm still struggling with this phrase, cash to close, because the problem is with the word close. Are you talking about selling the property?
Selling the property, that's right. So these
are people who need money in order to sell their property.
Exactly. Okay. So again, just to be clear on this, so the idea is that I bought a home that, you know, had gone up in value, so it had been worth $250,000 at one point. Now it's worth $180,000. I still owe $200,000 on it.
Think of it as negative equity.
Negative equity.
So that's all the term we need.
Excuse me?
That's sufficient explanation. People follow that.
Okay.
Negative equity.
What we call it.
Okay, so what are my takeaways on this? Well, one of the things that has been really striking, if you look at our labor market in the downturn, has been, you know, on the one hand, you know, the big fall off in labor force participation, or these are actually employment to population ratios, so 1% of these age groups are employed, for prime age workers and also younger workers. You know, if you look at our unemployment rate today, there's a big debate now with the Fed, should they be tightening, because, you know, our unemployment rate isn't all that high. It's really higher than it was before the downturn, but 6.7 in the latest data. That doesn't look too bad. On the other hand, if you look at the employment to population ratio for prime age workers, it's still down almost 4 percentage points from the pre-recession levels. So a very big hit. What's happened is a lot of people have dropped out of the labor force. This is, again, something we have arguments about all the time. It seems to me kind of silly we're having the arguments, because the people say the baby boomers are all retiring. Well, that's fine, but, you know, the point here is people 45 to 54 aren't retiring for the most part, and a lot of those people are retiring. So, you know, sidebar here, but, you know, clearly a very weak labor market.
But my main point in showing this slide isn't the downturn, you know, for the prime age workers. It's that there isn't really much of a downturn for the 55 to 64. Okay, so you see some fall off. We're up around 61 and a half at the start of the, before the recession. It's down around 60 and a half. So there's very little fall off for these older workers, 55 to 64. Well, what you would expect, and I would say what you would want, at least what I would want, is if you have a severe labor force, severe downturn, you'd have a lot of older workers go, okay, you know, time to leave, you know, I was thinking of retiring anyhow, you know, what the hell, you know, in some cases people are losing their job and they're finding other jobs, but in any case, you know, it might be a good time to retire, a good time to get out. Well, very few older workers do. And I have data, I don't show it here, but if we took the age group older than this, 65 to 74, their employment to population ratios actually increased. Okay, so we get this very perverse result. People obviously were adverse to retirement. I'm not trying to throw anyone out of the labor market, but I think it is unusual that you suddenly get this behavior that, you know, at a time when ordinarily we would see a lot of workers retiring, they're not. And, you know, obviously that's bad news for them if, you know, they in principle would like to retire. But it's also just a bad picture for the labor market. We would like to see these people with jobs. We'd like to see these people with jobs. We don't want to see people who would otherwise be retired, who want to retire with jobs. Okay.
The trouble with those employment figures is that somebody who is employed includes all of those people who are so underemployed by people like Walmart that they're living off of food allowances.
Yeah, well, we've had a big deterioration in the quality of our jobs. I mean, you can get me going on this for quite a while, but you know, it's, and again, one of the things, you know, an argument we often have in the U.S., you probably have a similar argument in the U.K. about, you know, is the problem people don't have skills. We've analyzed this. A lot of the people are taking jobs at Walmart's and McDonald's are people with college degrees. And you're very hard pressed. I mean, people make that argument. You go, okay, so what are the skills we're in short supply of? Because we've looked at the data on this. Even for people with college degrees, their wages have been flat over the last decade. In fact, probably down a little bit. You know, so you go, how does this work? You know, if we're in short supply, why aren't the wages rising? You know, that's ordinarily how economists would look at it. So anyhow, so yes, the story would probably be a little worse than just showing that graph. Okay, so just, you know, my takeaways, you know, I didn't talk about Social Security, but, you know, again, this is something we endlessly have to fight over in the United States because we have at least a substantial segment, really both political parties, so it's not partisan, I mean, somewhat a partisan issue, more Republicans than Democrats, but there's a lot of Democrats who like to cut it as well. Social Security has been growing in its importance of retirement income, its share of retirement income. So for most people, for the majority of the population, it's about 70%, actually 65% of the population, it's more than half of their income. And I have an argument with a conservative Republican. He's corrected me on this. I have to be a little careful. It's about two-thirds of the population. It's more than half of their income. That statement's a little problematic because that doesn't count payouts from defined contribution pensions. Okay, so it'd be a little bit less than that, but it doesn't hugely change that. We've gone back and forth on this. The point that I make is, you know, basically comes from what I just showed you. Most middle-income people don't have substantial payouts from defined contribution pensions, so that can't change that picture very much. But in any case, so Social Security continues to be the main source of income for the vast majority of retirees. Defined benefit pensions are disappearing. Defined contribution pensions, you know, again, we could argue what they should look like. But the reality is, you know, for the people who are near retirement in the United States, and I know it's the same in the UK, it's a lot of people with the baby boom, it's not, they aren't going to be there. I mean, whatever we do with defined contribution pensions, you know, come up with our great schemes, that's not going to help someone who's 55 today, or at least not in any big way. So, you know, the reality is defined contribution pensions aren't there now for people who are about, a large number of people about to retire. Home equity, again, is the main asset. The last point I just make about this, and you know, I'm just sort of struck by the lack of attention to this, you know, both among macroeconomists when we talk about goals of the central bank, and really also among retirement people who work on retirement issues. This is the reality. Home equity is the main asset for most of the population, and to not take the volatility of home prices seriously. You know, I've had discussions with, you know, people talking about Fed policy, and I don't know if it's debated here, but, you know, they're like, oh, is Alan Greenspan supposed to worry about home prices? I go, yeah. You know,
I mean, what the, you know, I have to watch my language here. You know, what's the difference if the inflation rate, I've never really quite understood it. We're supposed to be very concerned if the inflation rate goes from 2 to 3%. I've lived long enough to go, 3% inflation isn't bad. You know, the economy doesn't collapse. You know, people don't go to the grocery store with wheel carts of money to buy a loaf of bread. That's not the world, you know. So, you know, yeah, it's better to have a lower inflation rate than a higher inflation rate, but it really doesn't matter. You know, so the obsession that, oh my God, inflation might rise a little bit versus, no, you should have your eye on house prices. Yeah, you should have your eye on house prices, which doesn't mean that Alan Greenspan has to go around. I'm picking on, you know, two Fed chairs back, but, you know, he was the person sitting there at the time. Of course, he doesn't have to go around pricing individual houses. It was really hard to miss the bubble in the United States. I'll let you speak for the UK yourself. But we had an unprecedented run-up in house prices. Nothing in the fundamentals could come close to justifying it. It was easy to see. So it wasn't a question of Alan Greenspan getting the microscope out and trying to figure out, you know, this blip or that blip. It was like that. You know, and it had huge consequences. It had huge consequences. Again, you know, we often talk about the labor market. We're still way below full employment. And again, this is our Congressional Budget Office puts our output at about $1 trillion, about 6% below potential GDP. So that's a big loss. And you aggregate that, we're talking about a loss probably in the order of $10 trillion. That's real money. But on top of that, you know, this is people's retirement. And, you know, so that was history, but, you know, it is ongoing, and, you know, it does seem that there are some English-speaking countries that, again, have a bubble. Prices in Canada are very high. Some other countries. But again, I mean, this really should be a concern for central banks. The other point I'll just make, and again, I'm referring to the U.S., but I think you have the same sort of ideology in the U.K. You know, in the United States, it's like everyone should be a homeowner. It's the American dream. Well, that really is something that requires a lot more thought, because house prices always have a significant element of volatility to them. Now, nationally, typically, if you look at the United States, before the bubble years, national house prices really weren't that volatile. So we could look back from the Great Depression till, you know, the mid-90s, the late-90s. They pretty much tracked the overall rate of inflation. There's little ups and downs, but nothing, you know, nothing resembling a bubble. You know, it didn't matter hugely whether you bought, sold in 75 and 85. I mean, there weren't huge changes that way relative to the rate of inflation. The bubble was the exception. But there always are, you know, regional differences and a lot of regional volatility. Just to give an obvious example, you know, we had Detroit, you know, with, well, the city going bankrupt. We had our automakers going bankrupt. Well, if you own a home in Detroit, I have friends, I went to grad school in Michigan, I have friends who live in the area. They were selling me clippings of what looked to be middle-class houses. You know, they're neighborhoods I knew a little bit. They were middle-class neighborhoods when I was there. They had houses selling for $15,000. Okay, so suppose you're an auto worker that lost your job, and you had one of those houses that now sells for $15,000. You didn't pay $15,000 for it, but that's what it goes for now. Okay, well, this is kind of like taking all your savings and using it to buy the stock of the company you work for. Okay, all of us know that's a stupid thing to do, but that's what buying a home could be in many cases. I mean, that's not going to be true everywhere, you know, but certainly Detroit and the auto industry, that's true. Okay, and there are other places you could look to like that. So you're always going to have that element of volatility, and then on top of that, if you do have bubbles, as we saw in the U.S. and U.K. and perhaps again in the U.K., that creates a very large amount of volatility, which, you know, to me suggests that it's not something we should necessarily encourage everyone to be a homeowner. Okay, it's a highly risky asset. And, you know, back in the bubble years, I remember having conversations with people, and, you know, I don't know how many times I heard this line, you know, I put it in the ungodly stupid category. People would say, you could always live in your home. And you go, what does that mean? You know, so you just spent $100,000 too much for a home, but you could live in it. You threw $100,000 in the garbage. So anyway, you know, again, I know this conference is supposed to be about pensions, but I think of pensions as part of retirement income. And, you know, my takeaway on this is that housing is a really big part of the story. And I think our housing policy has been incredibly backward. And that's led to some really disastrous outcomes for people, both for the aggregate economy, but also for people in terms of their retirement income. So I'll stop with that.
Questions for Dean?
Yeah,
further. Okay, interesting. I wanted to ask about how we actually try and measure the well-being of
people of a certain age, and when we have income figures that we obtain from things like income and expenditure at a certain rate, we don't, in general, take account of something called imputed rent. Do we actually have the ability to generate a value for the imputed rent in order to be able to understand how well people are doing? Once upon a time, in this country, certainly, we used to tax people on imputed rent, but we don't do that anymore. So, the other thing is, yes, how do we actually deal with it might be large, and often it is actually rather small, income that comes from defined contribution pension schemes, which is actually taken as drawdown rather than as a source of income from something like an annuity. Because again, we actually don't really know what is going on there. And I think that there is a problem which certainly I have faced as a researcher, is that it's actually in this changed environment terribly difficult to know what is really going on. If your thought just makes that very clear. So it's a question about whether you can do it in the USA, and I don't know how much you can do that in the UK. Perhaps somebody from the DWP would comment on that.
Yeah, well, in terms of the U.S., I mean, our data sets are very imperfect for this, you know, which, you know, it's one of these things. Certainly the imputed rent issue, the main data set we use for income is the current population survey, and that doesn't have data on house prices. Now, we do have other data sets. The survey on income and program participation is a much smaller data set. It comes out less frequently. That you can do that. That does have data on house prices, and then you could get an imputation of rent from that. Obviously very imperfect. The drawdowns, you know, we don't, you know, this is something, again, I felt stupid for having not realized it. You know, again, I argue enough with conservative economists, and one of them pointed out to me, oh, this doesn't have the drawdowns. I go, oh, yeah, you know, obviously it's an asymmetry that, you know, someone has a defined benefit pension or annuity, we're counting that as income, but drawdown doesn't get counted. So we don't have a really good data set for that. You could, again, try to back that out from the Survey of Consumer Finance, which is a relatively small data set, comes out with a considerable lag. We can try to do that, say, okay, if you have so much in an account at, you know, say, you know, a retirement account at age 65, we can impute a certain rate of drawdown, you know, which would give us a ballpark number, but it's a very imperfect way of doing it.
You know, we're supposed to be more like Australia, according to our Chancellor, who was speaking probably as he was sitting on the elevator. I mean, this is a big problem there, because you have got a superannuation system which gives people a great wad of money, and eventually, on retirement, not annuitized, potentially drawn back.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a problem in the data. You know, good side of this from the data standpoint is we know that most people don't have much money in these plans, so we can say they can't possibly be drawing down that much. But
I'll just come in and offer Bernard a comment. You've got the Bank of England Home Equity Withdrawal series, which is freely available. You've also got, if you go to Stats Usenet, you'll find that there are numerous discussions on various price indices, consumer price indices, and retail price indices, which come in both cum and ex imputed rental values. In fact, there's vast amounts of discussion on there, including quite a few contributions from me. It runs for about a year and a half for the entire sequence of events. Sorry, back to Dean.
First of all, thank you for all this. I've been following you online for years, and you're the reason I'm here, basically. You quite rightly spent a lot of time talking about figures before and after the credit crash. Given the fact that the principal cause of it, namely the total lack of any division between commercial banking and investment banking, is still there, how much money would you put on it not happening again on an even larger scale?
That's a really good question. You know, I think there were a lot of things that could have been done to stop it, and I sort of hope that, you know, the Fed, Greenspan could have taken steps to stop it, and I sort of hope that the Fed would stop it. Now, one of the things that was striking to me, last year, our house prices were rising very rapidly. They were rising double-digit rates. That was a national average. You had a lot of areas where prices were literally going, growing at a 30, even 40% annual rate. Those tended to be the most beat up markets. So, you know, growing at a 30, 40% annual rate, that's okay if your prices are maybe 30% below your long run value. But if you're growing at a 30, 40% annual rate and you do that for very long, you're back in bubble territory, obviously. Now, what happened, Bernanke back in June gave his famous taper talk. And he said, you know, the Fed will start tapering, blah, 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 blah. And the markets flipped. You know, the interest rates rose like a percentage point. And that looked to take the air out of the bubble. So a lot of the data that came in, and I'm speaking of the U.S., I'm not going to say for the U.K., a lot of the data that came in subsequent months indicated a considerable weakening in the market. Fall off in sales, a lot of numbers on prices were showing, you know, much less increase. I've been looking at the more recent data. It's hard to read. Now, Bernanke never mentioned anything about being concerned about a bubble, nor did almost anyone in the business press. I was just amazed. I was like the only one saying, you know, because it would have made great sense. I would have said it was absolutely brilliant if, you know, he was able just by talking to pull the air out of a bubble, you know. But whether that was his intention, I have no idea. But anyhow, I would hope that, you know, the Fed, having been through this experience, does realize they have to have responsibility to prevent a bubble. You know, will the financial system, you know, support it? Absolutely. You know, we have our main mortgage secondary mortgage market are two public companies that are now literally public. The Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. These were started both by the government and then they were privatized. So they had this kind of mixed public-private character. And then they would have been bankrupt. They were taken over by the government. And so now they're basically fully public, but there's support, you know, wide support on both sides, Republicans and Democrats, to make them private again. And what they want to do, I mean, to my mind, it's sort of ungodly stupid. What they want to do, I'd be okay if you just say, get rid of them and leave it to the private market, but that's not what they're proposing to do. What they're proposing to do is have private issuers of mortgage-backed securities issue mortgage-backed securities that carry a guarantee of 90% from the federal government.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they seem to think this 10% loss is going to encourage good behavior. And I'm going, wait a second, weren't all these people selling mortgage-backed securities that had no guarantee from the government?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if they do that, I'm just thinking, like, you know, this is just, you know, we're just asking for the same thing again.
Capitalism for the poor, socialism for the rich.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm having a bit of trouble working out clear, so what could be done apart from the bubble point, from what you're saying. I don't think you can change the problem that the US shares with the UK and the rest of the world, and that international competition is reducing the competitivity of most workers. But as well as ceasing to be... But as well as ceasing to be so terrified about asset price falls, might one idea be discontinuing the way in which interest on loans is deductible against tax?
You know, this is something, if you talk to economists across the political spectrum, and get, you know, your favorite Republican economist, Martin Feldstein, whoever, you know, they'll agree with me that, you know, that doesn't make sense, that we should cap it and arguably make it a credit, you know. So insofar as we want to support home ownership, we don't have, if you're able to buy a $900,000 home, the government doesn't have to give you a subsidy, you know, so that's, you know, what you end up doing with that system is you give the biggest subsidies, and of course it's proportional to your tax rates. If you're in the 39% bracket, it's a much larger subsidy than, you know, a typical person's in a 15% bracket. Some of them don't even itemize, so they don't even get the subsidy, you know. So capping it, you know, at a much lower level, say around 400,000, and making it a credit, say it was 15 cents on the dollar for everyone, something like that among economists would, you know, probably would get 90, 95% of, you know, people call themselves economists signing up for that. Now, the politics on that, realtors are a very powerful lobby, builders, you know, and they immediately, you know, as soon as it gets talked about, they're all out there, oh my God, you're going to keep middle-income people from buying homes. And, you know, there's a lot of horrible, horrible reporting on this. I mean, one of the things I do, I have a blog, Beat the Press, where I beat up on reporters. Because they'll go, oh my God, you know, because the realtors will find someone who got a $450,000 home and, you know, a nice middle class family, and now they're going to lose their tax break. You go, no, you're able to deduct all but the last $50,000, but they really harp on that. They'll have someone who got a home that, you know, the cap's $400,000, their mortgage is $402,000, and there'll be 2,000 they can't deduct, and you know, this is a real sob story.
It was reduced the stages here. It was unlimited, then they limited it to, I don't know, 30 or 50, but, and eventually inflation made that less significant due to moving altogether.
Well, ours is, you know, isn't tied to the inflation rate, so if we go out 30 or 40 or 50 years, we'll probably be about where we want. But it'll take a while. Is it quite, yeah.
Yeah, well, financial advisor to a pension scheme, maybe here today, they reckon that the UK market, not this London, but the UK market is 25% above fair value. I could see we are in a bubble here in the UK. Also, they said the biggest problem for the UK economy is household debt, not government debt. And then America is in a much better position than us because you had your crash and you wrote off tons of household debt. So do you think a crash in the UK could be a good thing?
Can I answer this one for you, Dean?
Sure.
The UK differs in one important dimension from the US, which is that in this country, we systematically underproduce housing. We have been, since the late 1950s, we have been, and arguably even in the immediate post-war period, we were underproducing residential accommodation. This is NIMBYism, it's the planning laws, it's lots of things. Last year we needed to produce 232,000 houses to stay even with the growth of households, and allowing also for the replacement of that which has died. We actually produced 126,000. Now, to catch up with the systematic undersupply, we need to produce about 400,000 houses a year for 5 years. The actual production capacity of our construction industry is about 210,000, so it ain't going to happen. Net-net, we are systematically in a bubble when it comes to residential accommodation. And unfortunately, that also knocks onto rental prices. Okay? And most notably, it knocks onto rental prices in urban areas. What should we do? Produce 400,000 houses a year, employ a lot more people in the construction industry, and expect to get shot by people whose house prices have collapsed.
Or produce 400,000 fewer people.
No, we're not allowed to. They're all Europeans.
In terms of the U.S. position, you know, it's, you know, our consumption levels are actually quite high. So, you know, consumption relative to GDP or disposable income, whichever metric you want to use, it's higher than any point except at the peak of the bubble. So, in that sense, we fully recovered. But, you know, again, our economy still, you know, the biggest problem I would say with our economy is we have a very large trade deficit. It's still about 3% of GDP. And
only 3.
It had been as high as 6. It had been up at 6 back in 2005 was where it peaked. You know, so some of the fallout, well, three things that led to the fallout. One is simply because we're still so far below potential GDP. I mean, if our GDP expanded by 6%, the trade deficit would increase probably by a percentage point or a little more. So that's one part of the story. Secondly, the dollar has fallen. It probably is further to fall, but the dollar has fallen back from the peaks we were at. It peaked, I think, 2002. So it's fallen about 15-20% in real terms. And the third thing is that we have increased energy production, our fracking. We've increased energy production, so our imports of energy has fallen. That's probably knocked off half to a full percentage point of our trade deficit. Yeah.
And you think expecting there to be a large volume of larger houses coming onto the market as people either downsize or die off? And the re-employment of the younger workforce, is that going to compensate for that volume, or are you expecting that volume to drive a crash in prices at some point?
Well, we had a big fall in prices. So our story, our prices as a national average fell about 30%. You know, and again, huge differences by region. So some of the areas where the bubble was biggest, Las Vegas, Nevada, Phoenix, Arizona, you had prices drop by around 60%. Biggest falls tend to be at the bottom end of the market because that was where the biggest run-ups were. But still, it was across the board. So question is, you know, whether there's still huge overvaluation. I wouldn't expect plunging. I think it'd be very much a regional issue. So if you have an area that, you know, is otherwise growing, where you have, you know, some of these big houses being built, prices might fall a little bit. I don't see them plunging. An area that's otherwise weak, you know, where population, you know, say the Detroit area, yeah, those big homes, people are going to take a real bath on.
I guess like the driver's different. On the one hand, for the earlier collapse was more driven by the credit expansion then collapsing. What I'm really asking the question is more of a demographic shift. So the reason for the collapse is a bit different.
Yeah, well, that won't really be a collapse. I mean, you might have people's, you know, gradual drops in the prices. I mean, these were very dramatic. You know, a lot of places where house prices dropped 20 or 30% a year. The story you're talking about is, you know, house prices may be falling behind inflation by, you know, 2 or 3 percentage points. That could well happen. You know, in fact, as a practical matter, that happens all the time. So, you know, you do obviously see, you know, both variation across region and within region. You know, neighborhoods become more desirable, become less desirable.
Jane and Dennis.
In the spirit of bringing this back a bit towards pensions, two questions. One is, what innovation have you seen in the States in terms of turning home equity into income without ripping people off, which seems to be the big fear? And the second question, I saw Robert Shuler speak a number of years ago about insurance against house price falls. It's been one of the key things for all the reasons you've said. And I wondered what had happened about that.
Well, in terms of innovations, really the reverse mortgage is probably the big innovation that is catching on and spreading. And I guess what I worry about that is that very often those do come with very high fees. And also a lot of people don't understand them. You know, it's, you know, by definition, you're talking to an older population. I'm not saying they're all senile or anything, but, you know, certainly some of these people could be taken advantage of. So, many of the places, you know, issuing reverse mortgages, I think, are entirely kosher and, you know, they're fair, you know, but I think there's a lot of room for exploitation. Certainly that already has happened. So I think that's an area where, you know, I know there's mixed views on government regulation, but I think it's one where it's really called for, you know, because it's a population potentially is very vulnerable. And this is all they have in many cases. So I think that's a very important thing. Shuler's effort at insurance, he has they started the Case-Shiller indexes, 20 city indexes, and you could buy futures on them in effect, you know, so you could buy a future, you know, or short it, you know, whichever way you want to go. Almost no one uses that as insurance. So in terms of that having caught on, I mean, it's designed for that. I mean, I understand that was his intention, and, you know, I thought it was creative, but I might have done that. You know, I had a condo in Washington, D.C. that, you know, I was following this. I go, this is crazy. So my wife and I sold it back, you know, for pretty much, you know, we lucked out. I mean, it wasn't insider. I mean, we knew prices were high, but it turned out to be almost the absolute peak of that market, you know, but that was luck. But in any case, I would have, if this Case-Shiller index had been around at that time, I would have been happy to do that and, you know, bet against the Washington market to cover, you know, to cover my home. But almost no one is doing that. So. And I don't know, you know, he sold that to Standard & Poor's, and then they sold it off to someone else. I mean, I think the intention in selling it to Standard & Poor's was that they would market insurance from it. And again, I never, it really has not caught on at all. I mean, I'd have to think more about why it had. I think it just sounds too strange.
It's a very perverse institution, Dean. If you think about it, an investment institution that has a vested interest in increasing house prices, increasing rental costs, and so on. This is a very anti-social body. I don't think in it. Fine to do it at the margins, but I don't think we want to go about doing this systematically.
Yeah, it's not my ideal either. I mean, my ideal would be, you know, I think the central bank has to take responsibility to prevent bubbles. I mean, that doesn't mean every fluctuation, but again, this one was easy to see.
We are running massively over time. Any burning questions that have to be asked now? Alternatively, go on. Burning question.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming. I mean, I'm a great fan of your writings when you write in The Guardian and so on, and I follow you on Twitter. I had a question, not about your talk, but about, one of the arguments we hear a lot is that the baby boomers have stolen their children's future. I know that you've written about intergenerational equity. I wonder if you'd like to say a little bit about that.
Yeah, in the United States, I have no idea how much this goes on in the same terms in the UK, but in the United States, there's this refrain that you constantly hear, and again, it's bipartisan, it's more Republican than Democrat. Plenty of Democrats will say this too, that, you know, we have this horrible story here with, you know, the baby boomers are retiring and they're going to give this huge liability to their children and grandchildren when you form Social Security and Medicare, and that's going to, you know, lead to this disastrous situation where, you know, their taxes will be eaten up, this and that. And I guess I'd say a couple things on it. First off, we've raised social insurance taxes repeatedly in the U.S., so baby boomers, and I'm guilty myself being a baby boomer, we're paying much more than our parents did. You know, so our Social Security tax is now 12.4 percentage points, half employer, half employer. If you go back to 1960, it was three on each, you know, so six in total. So, and Medicare didn't exist in 1960, now it's 2.95%. So, but the other point is that, you know, people's living standards is far more determined by their before-tax income than their after-tax income. And, you know, if you envision that workers will get their share of economic growth, the productivity gains, even in a bad scenario, just 1% a year, which is worse than we ever had, if you carry that out 30 years, you're talking about average wages being 40% higher. So if you envision, you know, we're looking out 30 years, average wages are 40% higher, let's say workers pay another 2, 3, 4 percentage points in taxes, after-tax income is still hugely higher than it is today. So in that story, it's very hard for me to see, you know, an issue of inequity, generational inequity. What I always say, you know, well, 2 points. One, workers haven't been seeing the gains because we've had so much upward redistribution of income. So that is a very big issue, but that's intergenerational, not inter. And then the other point, which, you know, I say this to people when they bring the, you know, talk about generational equity, they're going like, why are you bringing this up? Well, global warming, you know, it's not a joke, you know. So 30 years from now, if we don't do anything, you look at our baselines and you won't find a lot of dispute among, I'm not a scientist, but I've talked to enough, not a lot of dispute there. We're talking about giving them a really messed up world. So, I mean, I always go, okay, so let's say we fix it so that we don't ever have to raise our Social Security taxes, but we have the baseline in global warming. I don't think I could feel good about that as a generational equity story.
Bernard, I hope this is burning.
It is very small. Yet how much, however, are people actually having to dispose of their homes to pay for care when they become old and fragile? Because actually, this is one of the places where this wealth gets burned up. Pensions don't pay for it, disability insurance doesn't pay for it, private insurance they don't have, and that's where it gets burned up.
Yeah, I don't know if you have the same situation in the U.S. In the United States, Medicare, which is a great system providing for, you know, much of the medical needs of seniors, doesn't cover home health care, doesn't cover long-term care. So you have a lot of people in their last years, they're disabled, they need care. It's extremely expensive in the U.S. I'm sure it's expensive here, but probably not as expensive in the U.S. So you have middle-class people, you know, a decent standard of living in their lifetime. They have a home, they have, you know, say $150,000 in equity in their home. That's going to have to pay for their long-term care. So it's not something they plan for, but they're often in that situation. So it's not a pretty picture. And there were efforts, one of the components of the Affordable Care Act was actually to have a system of long-term care insurance. I mean, you could buy it, but very few people do, but it was to have a government-provided system. And they wouldn't go along with making it mandatory. They decided they couldn't get that through Congress. So they made it optional, and then they realized it was going to be a joke because, you know, no one would buy into it except the people who knew they were going to need it, then, you know, kills it, you know, adverse selection. So we're nowhere on that. It's a really big problem.
But
people
whose home equity
has
been wiped out by the husband.
They don't have to worry about
it. A real problem.
Like, well, what happens is our Medicaid system, which is for low-income people, does pay for it. Now, that has an asset test. So basically, you have to spend down your wealth. Now, it's been a common source of basically fraud that you have a lot of middle-class people that, to avoid this, they find a way to give the money to the kids. It's become harder to do that, but people still do it, you know, so they pass the money out to the kids, and then they get the government program. You know, it's not a good way to do it.
It works slightly differently here. Here, long-term care is provided for at the level of the local authority. There's a major study done on it, which I guess was published last year or maybe the year before, Andrew Dilnot. One of the solutions is that he wants to introduce forms of insurance against long-term incapacity and the needs for long-term care.
Would it be mandatory?
Currently, this is all I don't actually know what the current state of that debate is. I haven't followed the...
Because we have the insurance, but no one buys it, so that's the thing. It's, you know...
The, well, here, I think there's talk of introducing degrees of compulsion. The situation here is if you have wealth of in excess of, I think, about £16,000, then you know, the local authority first takes what you've got and then will provide in extremis